Good afternoon. Illinois Appellate Court, First District Court is now in session. The Sixth Division, the Honorable Justice Mary L. Mickford presiding, case number 17-2005, People versus Daniel Garcia.
Thank you, Darren. Counsel, welcome. Before we begin and before we start timing you, I'd like each of you to please introduce yourselves, tell us who you're going to represent. And for the appellant, please let us know if you want to reserve any of your 20 minutes for rebuttal. So beginning with the appellant.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Assistant Appellate Defender Matthew Daniels. I represent the appellant Daniel Garcia. I'd be asking to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Of course. Counsel?
Good afternoon. I'm Lisa Morrison. I'm an Assistant State's Attorney and I represent the people of the state of Illinois.
All right, Mr. Daniels, whenever you're ready, you may please.
Thank you. May it please the court, counsel. Daniel Garcia was convicted of serious offenses, and his sentence will keep him in prison until he is at least 112 years old. But those convictions and that sentence should not stand for two reasons. First, Daniel's trial was unfair because the jury didn't know that he was intellectually disabled, and that evidence wasn't presented until after trial. And Daniel's intellectual disability was vital to understanding his demeanor and assessing his credibility. Second, on this record, an aggregate sentence of 100 years was excessive, where the trial court offered 36 years during a pretrial Rule 402 conference. Accordingly, this court should grant Daniel a new trial or grant him sentencing relief.
I need to emphasize, if you will, without abandoning your argument that he should get a new trial, just to save some time for the sentencing issue, because that is of particular interest to us.
Sure. And if Your Honor's wish, I can go right to that right now.
Start there. That would be fine. We understand.
Sure. Okie doke. What I'd like to focus on regarding the sentencing arguments we've made is the excessive sentence issue that I raised. That's issue 2B of our briefs. Under that particular argument, our argument is that the trial courts imposed an excessive sentence in giving Daniel that 100-year sentence. That was an abuse of discretion. As I said a moment ago, during pretrial proceedings, the trial court offered Daniel 36 years imprisonment for the same four counts that he ended up going to trial and getting convicted of. And yet we have an ultimate sentence here that is 100 years. That's quite a disparity. It's almost three times what the trial court offered.
But counsel, isn't it correct that sometimes what happens is that after the judge has heard all the evidence at trial and heard all of the victim impact statements and so forth, that can sometimes change the judge's mind regarding sentencing?
It can, Your Honor. And I acknowledge that just because the trial judge offered 36 years at the Rule 402 conference, it doesn't mean that he was required to give him only 36 years. I understand that a plea offer has implicit within it the fact that court resources are being saved, that witnesses don't have to come in, and so on and so forth. And I also acknowledge that with respect to the judge learning new information, either at the trial or at sentencing, that can be a basis for increasing the sentence above what was offered at a 402. But two things to keep in mind. One is that in those situations where the judge has learned something new and that has given him or her a reason to increase the sentence from the pretrial offer, usually what that means is that there's going to be an incremental increase in what that offer was. Here, this obviously is not an incremental increase. It's nearly triple what the judge offered during the pretrial hearing. And on this record, it's clear that what we're really dealing with is a trial tax. What we've got here is a unique situation where the judge at sentencing is saying that he's giving a 100-year sentence primarily because of the seriousness of the offense. Yet, when we look at this record, during the pretrial proceedings, by the time that 402 conference had, the judge already had a very detailed understanding about just how serious these offenses were. And I'll direct the court's attention to the motion to reconsider bond hearing that the court presided over back in 2015. If you'll recall, at that point, Daniel was on a no bond hold from bond court. Daniel filed a motion to reconsider that bond. And since the state wanted to keep that no bond hold, the court heard from the state a very extensive proffer about the facts and details of the case, starting from the point where Daniel was at the gas station and gets into the car and drives off, through the details of the sexual assaults, the multiple acts of aggravated criminal sexual assault, learns about the threats that he made, saying that he had a gun, that he was going to kill the victim's date, that Daniel was part of a cartel. The judge knew about the fact that he then drove her back to the south suburbs, made her take money out of her bank account. He took that money. He knows that the judge knows that Daniel had then taken the car. The judge also heard about the fact that there was a outcry, that there was a sexual assault kit that was performed, that there was a positive.
Now, so do we know whether the judge at the 402 conference was apprised of the defense theory of the case, that it was a case of consent?
I don't know for sure, Your Honor. I'd have to go back and look to see when the affirmative defense of consent got filed. My recollection is he probably would have been, because if I remember correctly, what happened was that the 402 was conducted by the public defender who had been representing Daniel shortly before trial began. And at that point, my recollection of the record is correct, that a answer had already been filed and it had that consent defense.
And is it true that there were two hearings on the motion to reconsider?
It's true.
Okay. So you can assume we're very familiar with the briefs and the record. I want to sort of talk to you more theoretically about the notion of trial penalty. There's a debate in the academic world about whether the disparity should be a trial penalty or a incentive or discount to plead guilty. And there's lots of papers out there discussing it, lots of analytical studies. I'd like to hear from you on how you distinguish a incentive to plead guilty from a trial penalty. Is there a particular test that's to be employed? We're familiar with the Dennis case. We're familiar with the court's holding there that in addition to overt statements that a judge might make, suggesting that he penalized a defendant for exercising his right to trial, that a large disparity can also form the basis of an inference. And in the Dennis case, it was a 20 times factor. Here, it's not 20 times, and you're probably familiar with cases where courts have said, well, it wasn't 20 times like in Dennis, so therefore there was no trial penalty. We recognize here that this is a de facto life sentence. So how, in your view, do we decide this case if we're to decide it in your favor? What is there a test we employ? Or how would you advocate that we decide this case?
Well, to my knowledge, there is no specific test that the case law sets forth that this court employs. With that in mind, what I would say for this court to decide in our favor is to simply look at this record in its totality. This is sort of a unique
facts and circumstance.
It is. And on these facts, we have a very unique situation where there is undeniably a significant difference between what was offered before trial and what was ultimately the sentence. I realize it's not a 20 times increase, and it's hard to reach a 20 times increase, both because Dennis preceded determinant sentencing, because there are caps on what the maximum statutory maximum was for these offenses, and things like that. So I don't know that you're ever going to find a 20 times increase. And I don't know that there's a bright line rule either about there being, if it's X times above what the judge had offered before. That's why it seems to make the most sense, given the case law that we have, and the general principles that guide those decisions, that we need to be looking at the facts here. We know from the facts that
So we're familiar with the facts.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with a case that was decided subsequent to briefing in this case called People versus Walker in the Fourth District? There, the appellate court expressed skepticism, Dennis, found that its reasoning was shaky. Do you have anything like you'd like to tell us about that case?
I'm not familiar with Walker, so I don't have anything I can tell you right now. If there's more that this court would like to know from us about how Walker might impact Dennis or our excessive sentencing argument, I'd be happy to provide a supplemental brief addressing Walker directly. But unfortunately, I'm not in a position to be able to directly comment right now.
In terms of a trial text, I have another sort of philosophical question, which is, in addition to learning more facts in the case, the trial judge saw the defendant testify in testimony that the trial judge clearly found not just perjurious, but ludicrous. What's the role of that in terms of the judge's proper consideration of that?
I acknowledge that since the judge essentially made a adverse credibility finding about Daniel, that can be a basis for increasing the sentence. What doesn't change is that it provides a basis for an incremental increase in sentence. And what we have here is anything but an incremental increase. So that's, I think, an important piece of this discussion here, is that I'm not disputing the fact that the judge could and had some basis for saying, I know more now, and those additional pieces of information for me are additional aggravation that allow me to impose a sentence that's greater than what I offered before. But even when you take all of those things in their totality, it still should only get to a sentence that incrementally increases what he had offered before. And going from a sentence that would allow Daniel to be released when he was probably in his late 50s is far from a death in prison sentence. And that's not incremental. So that I think that would be my response to your question, Your Honor.
And Mr. Daniels, I'm going to take you back to Justice Taylor's question really quickly regarding Walker. In Walker, that was a case where the state had offered probation. It was a child sex case, and ultimately defendant was found guilty and the judge sentenced him to 35 years. And basically what the court held was that the judge was not involved in negotiations of that case and therefore really wasn't bound by anything. So you want to respond to how you see that case as just being totally different? And also, just as Justice Taylor mentioned, Walker also questioned whether or not Dennis was even correctly decided.
Yes, Your Honor. I'll preface this with, since I haven't read this case, I don't want to speak as if I can. There may be nuances here that I don't know. But from what you're describing to me, Justice Walker, if you're dealing with a situation where the pretrial offer didn't involve the judge in the Fourth District Walker case, that sounds different than what we have here, because we have a 402 conference here where it's pretty clear that the judge was involved. If you look at the record here, you see that the state was offering 40 years to dispose of this case on the four counts that ultimately went to trial. At the 402 conference, the judge offers 36. So
your argument is that the judge believed 40 years was excessive, huh?
At the time, yes. Yes. Okay. And I agree. Like, to go back to Justice McPhee's question, even Justice Taylor's, I understand that.
So you would acknowledge, though, when the judge came up with a 36-year recommendation, he factored in an incentive, right?
I think that's a reasonable inference to draw.
But your argument is that it can't all be an incentive, right? The difference between 36 and 100 years can't all be accounted for by an incentive, that some part of that difference is a penalty. That's your argument.
I think that's right, Your Honor, that you can have both of those coexisting. But when you have this kind of disparity of 64 years, what we have here is, even if we factor in that incentive, factor in what Justice McPhee was talking about regarding the adverse credibility determination, add in the additional context the judge may have received from the trial testimony or the victim impact statement, put all that together, that still doesn't explain how the judge gets to 64 years here, particularly where you have someone who we know is intellectually disabled. And we know from the case law that folks who are intellectually disabled are categorically less culpable.
So let's pivot to that argument, because that's another basis of your appeal, that the judge did not sufficiently or adequately consider your client's intellectual disability. And the record, in the record, the judge indicated that there are some records that they were 14 years old, that there's not been any live testimony. That might suggest that he disregarded intellectual disability. My question to you is, our Supreme Court has held that it's a double-edged sword, right? While this, statutorily, intellectual disability is a factor in mitigation, our case law recognizes that it also may be a basis to impose a longer sentence because the intellectually disabled person might be more prone to commit crime in the future. Is it your argument that because the circuit court didn't address the question of intellectual disability, that that's the basis for remand?
In part, and additionally, to get to that double-edged sword part of intellectual disability, this is not a case where the judge says that the reason he's imposing a 100-year sentence is because of future dangerousness concerns or that Daniel lacks any potential rehabilitation. Those are two pathways to using features of intellectual disability as aggravation for increasing the sentence. But here, when we look at the judge's findings when the sentence is imposed, he's relying strictly on the seriousness of the offense. So to the extent that those other possible ways intellectual disability can otherwise sort of be a backdoor route to aggravation, we don't have that here in this record based off of what the judge said.
I have one follow-up to that, which is because there was evidence of his intellectual disability in the record, we have to presume, do we not, that the trial judge did take that into account and properly took it into account, unless something rebuts that, or, and I'm asking if anything does rebut that presumption.
Your Honor, the 64-year add-on to the 36-year offer is the evidence that rebuts that presumption here. Okay.
So you look at those two together.
Yes, Your Honor.
And so, counsel, would any of your arguments change if the judge had doubled the sentence and given him 72 years, or if the judge had given him half of the, increased it by half and given him, say, 54 years? How would your argument here change today?
It's a difficult question to give a real definitive answer to. My intuition is that a 72-year sentence would put us in the same boat, because that's essentially still a death in prison sentence. 54 may still be close to that line. I would suggest that since our position is that there was a basis for an incremental increase above 36, something that was in the range of probably anywhere between 5 to 10 years would certainly be within the judge's.
Your argument really comes down to the notion that the sentence at trial has to have some resemblance to the sentence that was recommended at the 402. Would that be a fair
characterization? On this record, yes, Your Honor.
That's a fair characterization of your
argument? On this record, yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
One last quick question. Are we correct that Judge Sheehan, who was the trial judge, is no longer, has retired? Is that correct? You know?
That's my understanding, Your Honor.
Okay. Anything else? So that we don't get into his rebuttal time, is there anything else for you?
No, Your Honor, I'll stand on the briefs at this point and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal. Thank you.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. As I said earlier, I'm Assistant State's Attorney Lisa Morrison on behalf of the people. If Your Honors are okay with that for now, at least I'll start with addressing the issues that you've brought up with counsel for the defendant, specifically regarding this issue of the excessive sentence and specifically the allegation that this was a trial tax.
Are you familiar with that Walker case? Have you seen it?
I am, just like counsel said, I am unfortunately not. So I'm in the same disadvantage that he is, though I heard Justice Walker's kind of recitation of what its holding was. So unfortunately, we're both at the same disadvantage of not being able to give you a good discussion of that case. So I apologize for that.
I'll share with you that I'm not entirely clear on the rationale of the case, because although the court says a number of times that, if the trial judge is not involved in a 402 conference, then it cannot be you cannot characterize a sentence as a trial penalty. The court never actually indicates whether the trial judge in that case was involved in a 402 conference. So I don't really know what the rationale is. But you folks will look at the case.
We will. I'm sure as soon as this is over, that's the first thing we're both going to do.
Yeah, okay.
So I think in the context of a trial tax, the way that I've looked at it while preparing for this and writing the brief was, there's a difference in giving a defendant an incentive to plead guilty, to reduce the burden on the trial court system, to spare a victim, especially a victim who we obviously see through this record suffers from post-traumatic stress disorder from the attack, from her having to come in and face the defendant in court, from using resources, from all of these different people and our jurors coming in to handle the case. So there's a difference, I think, though, in providing him an incentive to acknowledge his wrongdoing, which I think arguably goes to his potential for rehabilitation, his ability to have said, this is on me, I shouldn't have done what I did, and I'm going to take my time for it. I think the judge has the right and should give an incentive to defendants who want to acknowledge wrongdoing where they're willing to do that. But I think there's a difference in giving.
You also recognize that someone who takes a plea isn't necessarily acknowledging wrongdoing. They're just weighing the pros and cons of going to trial.
Correct. And I think there are some defendants, though, that when they do plead guilty, obviously it is because they are guilty, and they know that the evidence is going to show that, and they may give a statement in allocution to that effect, that they are taking their time because they are acknowledging the harm done. But I think the most important thing to notice is there's a difference in giving the defendant an incentive and punishing him for exercising his constitutional rights. And so giving him an incentive to plead guilty, to especially in a case of this kind of trauma that was inflicted to avoid the trial process, I think that's why the state may offer something as low as they did in this case, because the state obviously has an incentive to make a lower offer. And typically, as your honors know, a 402 offer from the trial judge is typically lower than the offer that's made by the state's attorney. It gives the defendant the opportunity then to gain something by the bargain, to get some benefit from doing the 402 conference. And so I think it's important to note there's no evidence in this record that this—
Ms. Morrison, is it, yes. Am I understanding your argument here to be that the incentive here was greater than might normally be the case because this was a sex-related crime and it would impose substantial trauma on the victim to testify about it? Is that the position?
I think that it's hard to give a position where the judge wasn't given an opportunity to make a record on this because there was no motion for to attack the sentence. So we don't know what Judge Sheehan's reasoning was. But I do think in a case like this, it's reasonable from this record to assume that the state's attorney made a relatively low offer for given the egregiousness of this crime for a reason, and that the trial court then accepted that and undercut the state to some extent to give the defendant the benefit of his bargain, to give him an incentive to plead. We cannot say on this record why exactly the offer was what it was from the state or from the trial court, because we don't have that. We can only presume from the circumstances on the record that this would be, in my opinion, a reasonable explanation for why the offer was what I would consider pretty low going into the 402 conference from the state's attorney, as well as then lower so from the trial court.
Would you acknowledge that when the— and I know there's no record as to the trial judge's thinking when he made the recommendation. But would you acknowledge, as a general matter, when a trial judge makes a recommendation at a 402 conference, that he would, by necessity, have to consider the seriousness of the crime and trauma and harm caused to the victim?
I would think however much of that he was made aware of, he would have to consider.
And you acknowledge that here the trial judge was made aware of the salient facts that the state intended to prove.
I have no reason to doubt that, given, as counsel pointed out, the bond hearings and things that took place on this record.
And then would you finally acknowledge that the trial judge's recommendation would reflect the seriousness of the offense?
I think it would reflect it to the extent that he's able to comprehend it at that point. I think this case shows through the judge.
Let me just stop you there.
Yes.
You said comprehend it to that point. We have an experienced trial judge. It's not, you know, his first go around.
What's that?
I mean, I've heard from many trial judges at 26th Street that, you know, the trauma that they hear about on a day in and day out basis is mind numbing. So we're not talking about any babe in the woods here. Would it be fair for us to assume that, based on what the state advised the trial judge of, that he had a pretty good sense of the brutality and heinousness of this offense?
I think he would have had to have known a good portion of it. I don't know if he had quite a visceral picture of it. I think there's something different of hearing it first person from the victim's own mouth, watching her emotion and watching the emotion of the other people who interacted with her afterwards, seeing the photographs. We don't know if the judge saw the photos of injuries, heard about the medical testimony. We don't know how much of that the judge was aware of. Obviously, we know the judge knew that there was enough information to support the four different counts, the various types of penetration that we're dealing with the aggravated criminal sexual assault counts. So we know he knew the facts of that. But as the
do you acknowledge that the counts that were discussed at the 402 are the same counts that were tried?
I don't recall that specifically from the record, that it was clear that these were the exact counts.
Do you have any reason to doubt that?
I don't.
Okay.
No, typically, I mean, there are circumstances where the state's attorney will make an offer to go forward only on one count. But that's typically in a sex case where two counts is going to be mandatory life. There may be some movement on the counts. I have a feeling that it was probably the same, but I can't specifically recall from this record.
So Mr. Daniels argues that, you know, the case here is not your typical case. It's a case where there's a very large trial sentencing disparity, and that the actual sentence bears no resemblance to the 402 offer or recommendation, and therefore we ought to reverse on that basis. How do you respond to that?
I don't think that it doesn't bear a similarity to it. No matter how many years, if you're talking already 36 years and beyond, no matter how many years we're talking about, we're not talking about the difference of probation versus, you know, a decades long sentence. We're talking about decades in prison, and the reality of it being that this defendant, regardless, is either coming out of prison as an older man, quite older, or he's not coming out. I mean, but the reality of it is we're talking about a sentence of years. I don't believe that, even though it is quite a difference, the reality of life expectancy, a 100-year sentence, doesn't really change the outcome for him versus even the 36. He was not a particularly young man at the time of this offense. And
wait a second now, because he was 27 years old. So your position would be, even if the court had sentenced him to the maximum of 120 years, that still would not be a great disparity from the 36 years, because you just said you don't believe 100 years is such a great disparity. At least that's how you started. So right. Is that what you're saying now?
I don't think that we're talking about a disparity like probation versus a life sentence, or probation versus even incarceration, which are obviously two very different things.
So, and you believe that that's the only time that there's a great disparity such that this court should respond, is that there has to be probation and then some extended sentence? There's no other situation?
No, I don't. I think, as counsel said, every case is case by case. I don't think we can make a blanket rule one way or the other of what amount of doubling or tripling or 20 times the difference. I don't think we can make a bright line rule to say how much more it needs
to be. What about our Constitution's requirement to restore people to useful citizenship?
That's true. I think in this case, we need to look at the fact that the sentence was well within the range. There were 20 years that weren't tacked on by the judge. He specifically mentioned that. I mean, it's presumed proper because it's within the range, right? And then he also mentions, I'm considering all the statutory factors in aggravation and mitigation. He points out that counsel did present some mitigation. He says he's considering the PSI. On the record before us, this judge followed all of the requirements and did give due consideration to everything, including one of those factors, that being the rehabilitative potential of the defendant.
So given all of that, do you believe that the trial judge used the, mental health issues as a mitigating factor or as an aggravating factor?
I don't think that we can say from this record, but I don't believe this record gives any reason to believe he used it against him. Even though Cody says he could, I don't believe this record shows that he in any way considered this defendant's mental disability in any way against him. I think he did consider the way the defendant testified and what he testified to against him, but I don't believe, I think that was particularly insulting to the judge. He mentions that quite a bit about the defendant's story, his version of events, as
he thought he was the smartest person in the room and so forth.
Right. And, you know, I think even the greatest storyteller on earth, if they had told the story he did, it just doesn't hold water considering the other evidence against the defendant. The delivery isn't really the issue, but he did have an answer for everything, which is, you know, I mean, that's a defense. He's forced by the DNA evidence in this case into a consent defense. What else is he going to do? And so this is the way it went. But I believe the trial court, after hearing from the victim, who obviously was compelling based on how he responds to her, she's compelling. And then he gets up and tells a story blaming her for her own sex assault, that she wanted it. She wanted to then pay him. She wanted to give him a car. I think the judge was insulted by it. I think he found it to be perjurious and not judging him.
Can I ask you a question about that? Mm-hmm. The testimony of the defendant here, the judge determined, was essentially ludicrous. And, you know, there's a good basis for that. But could that, any of that be accounted for by his intellectual disability? You know, the fact that, you know, the judge observed that he thought he was the smartest person in the room. You know, this is the same guy who said he was with the cartel, that the cartel was sent, you know, to kill her, that the cartel threw him in a trunk. And, you know, there wasn't any evidence that any of that was true. There was, you know, defendant supposedly told the PSI investigator that he was a high ranking member of or leader in the Maniac Disciples, I think, gang. I don't know that there's any other evidence that that was true. It seems like this guy will say anything. And, you know, it sort of begs the question, is this guy really as cunning as he seems to be to the trial judge, or is he just so intellectually disabled that, you know, that could account for his testimony and also his behavior, right? Because, you know, there's some odd behaviors, you know, after he rapes her three times, he's stroking her hair and sharing his life story with her. And it just seems very odd.
I think it's important to notice in this case specifically, the defendant gave a statement as to the issue of, was he that cunning and is he just not able to come up with a way to defend himself in a believable way? This defendant is the same person who told the police when he was arrested that this is his girlfriend. She gave him the car and they didn't have sex. So he knew and was able to understand what was going on, that he was being investigated for this. I think that's probably, you know, he was evaluated for sanity, and obviously that didn't go anywhere in his favor. So that was not able to be explored as a defense. But this is the defendant who was able to come up with the smartest thing he could have said to explain away all of the circumstances that looked really bad for him at the point he gets arrested. He's driving a car that's been reported stolen by a rape victim, and she's making allegations that he sexually assaulted her. And he tells the police immediately, no, 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 that's my girlfriend. She gave me the car and we didn't even have sex. They're like, you know, there's going to be DNA. And he said, okay, we had some sex. And he is able to evolve his story to fit what he's being confronted with. I think that bears a lot on his ability to communicate. I think it's also kind of analogous. If you look, trial counsel initially, Rick Kress from the public defender's office, had the defendant evaluated for sanity. Both counsels talked about knowing he had the BCX done. Neither counsel ever requested any sort of fitness evaluation. You know, the issue would be, is he able to communicate with them and able to help in his own defense? You know, if he's so
these are two separate issues, though, right?
Correct.
We're not, when we're talking about intellectual disability, right, we're not talking about whether he, you know, whether he's sane. We're talking right. about.
What I was trying to explain was, if you look at the record, neither defense attorney ever indicates to the judge that they're having some sort of trouble having conversations with the defendant. If the issue is that he'll say anything and he's not taking it seriously, he's making up that he's a gang leader, whatever it might be, the record doesn't bear out that either counsel had trouble communicating with him in the way that is being alleged on appeal, that it's presumed everyone believes that he told the story in a terrible way and that he delivered it in a really incredible way, not judging it just on its substance, which is unbelievable in and of its substance. So the reason I brought up the idea of a fitness evaluation is that would be a clue to this court that trial counsel found him hard to communicate with, that he would be unable to assist in his own defense in a meaningful way, that he would be unable to communicate with them. The record is absent that either defense attorney ever had any concerns about the defendant's ability to convey information or convey information to this jury. So we're presuming, based on the arguments put forth by the defendant on appeal, that he was convicted because of his credibility issue and that he presents a certain way that we really don't know if he did, based on the record that's before us. The story itself is implausible. It doesn't matter how you tell it, is what I'm getting at. Even if he were a great communicator, there's no reason to believe this story would have held water. But the facts of it kind of force him into giving this story. There's not a lot you can do from a defense perspective when you are confronted with DNA evidence and he's caught with her car.
Let me ask you a different question. Can you pinpoint for me, and I don't recall, I'm sure it's in the record, where exactly the trial court is advised as to his low IQ and his mental health issue? Where is that?
So I know that both trial counsels before the trial told the court he was on SSI. So presumably that they were all aware at that point there was some disability. And then it's when those documents were purportedly recovered by the family in some unknown fashion after the trial that they found these documents from when he was a teenager and had been evaluated at school and for Social Security. When those were tendered to the court post-trial, I believe is the first time we got an actual number regarding IQ.
But were those also brought again to his attention at sentencing, or was it
I believe counsel did cite to all of those documents again at sentencing, and the court did say at sentencing that counsel has presented some mitigation. That's really the only mitigation counsel presented.
Sorry. Did the trial court make clear exactly what he was referencing?
No, there is not a specific quote from the trial court as to what he does say, though, that counsel did put forth, I believe his words were, some regarding mitigation after he says that he is considering all the factors, statutory factors in aggravation and mitigation, that he's taking into account the PSI with all of its additions and deletions that were made. And then he does say counsel put forth some, I think is his language that he uses. But again, we don't have a motion to reconsider the sentence to give him that opportunity to really explain where he was going with it. He made his record that he was within the statutory range, that he was considering everything he's required to consider. And then we never get to hear from him again as to all of his reasons. He more went through the facts of the case and the PSI and just kind of regurgitated the evidence he had heard. But there's nothing in the record then to say he was holding defendants' disabilities, whatever they may be, against him or anything of that nature.
Your time is up, but if anybody on the panel has any further questions, I think they'll say no. So if you have a final point you want to make, go ahead. But
just that for the reasons that I've stated in the brief and the ones we've discussed today, we'd request that this court affirm the defendant's conviction and sentence. Thank you.
Your Honor, it's just a couple of brief points I want to make. And then if there are any other questions the court has, I'm happy to answer those. First, to build on a point that Justice Taylor brought up a couple of minutes ago, there are those statements that the judge makes during sentencing about the testimony of Daniel and making the remarks that he thinks he's the smartest person in the room. Our position is that that does create concern that was an improper use of his intellectual disability in aggravating the sentence. And that's also in part and parcel with why this sentence was an abuse of discretion and excessive. Second, the one other
piece... Let me ask you very yes. quickly, is that a characteristic of an intellectually disabled person, that he might think he's the smartest person in the room, that he might think that he could hoodwink everybody?
Well, from what we know about intellectual disability, one of the adaptive living deficits that one can have is having speech and language deficits, as well as having an improper affect that's congruent with the surroundings in which you're speaking. Daniel had both of those. We know that from those records that were in the motion for new trial. So I think that's a fair nexus between those characteristics of intellectual disability and Daniel's presentation during his testimony.
What about Ms. Morrison's argument that, you know, Mr. Garcia is smarter than he, you know, claims to be because he was adapting his story, you know, as the investigation went along when he was questioned by the police, for example? You know, could you respond to that?
Well, it shows that he has an impulsive streak and wants to be pleasing to others, which is another characteristic of intellectual disability. I recognize that there may be a reason to look at this record and see that there are different ways to look at that statement from the judge about Daniel being the smartest person, but it's still our position that there's a real concern based on the totality of this record that it was being used improperly. And that gets me to the other point I want to highlight. The one other piece of the record that we haven't talked about that I think is important to remember when thinking about why there's this disparity in it being a trial tax, a punishment for going to trial, is that this record is clear that by the time of sentencing, the judge had a real displeasure with the defense. Daniel was supposed to go to trial in September, or I think October of 2016. A couple days before trial, he has the private lawyer who ends up being trial counsel come in. The judge wanted to still go to trial in October, and that's
so you know, you pointed out in your reply brief examples of what you say are the trial judge's frustrations with Mr. Avila, and you know, from that you infer that he took it out on Mr. Garcia at sentencing. I mean, you acknowledge, would you not, that in any trial there's going to be moments of tension between the trial judge and counsel? And what is it about this case that makes it exceptional?
There are moments of tension in any trial. I won't deny that. But on this record, I think this court has had enough experience in reviewing trial records to see that the antagonism here was something out of the ordinary, that there was a constant source of friction that was created by virtue of the decisions and the choices that counsel did or didn't make. Particularly once the trial starts, or actually even a little before, when they were litigating the pretrial motion on the rape shield statutes, all the way through to sentencing, that there was just a series of things that trial counsel did or didn't do that raised the peak of this judge. And it was a source of unending frustration. So unless there are any other questions from your honors, for the reasons that we set forth in the brief, we would ask this court to either grant Daniel a new trial or to grant him sentencing relief.
Thank you both for excellent briefs and argument. We'll take each other out of advice and we'll hear from the city folks. Thank you.